reaching into your community. The Great Southern Sounds of Melbourne, 88.3 Southern FM.
Well, it has now gone 7 o'clock, and that means it's going to be time for the space show. First up, let's take a listen to this.
I'm Apollo 16 astronaut Charlie Duke, the 10th man to walk on the moon.
Please join us from 7 to 8 p.m. on Wednesdays, October 15, 22 and 29, when we chat with Apollo 16 astronaut Charlie Duke.
The Space Show, Australia, on 88.3 Southern FM.
Well, welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie.
And I'm Peter Aylward. And on this evening's Space Show, we're going to, as Andrew mentioned, take a look at Rosetta, which is now orbiting only 10 kilometres from the centre of the comet Churyumov-Gerasimenko. And we're also going to start the first of our three-part exclusive interview with Apollo 16 astronaut Charlie Duke, the 10th man to walk on the moon, who joined us here in the studio a couple of weeks ago.
Well, coming up on the Space Show after this will be, yes, wait for it, moonwalker Charlie Duke.
G'day, my name's Stan. I'm from the Yorta Yorta tribe along the Murray River, and I'm here to talk about the Reading Writing Hotline. And the phone number is 1-300-655-06. So give them a call if you know someone that needs any help with their reading and writing.
I'm Apollo 16 astronaut Charlie Duke, the 10th man to walk on the moon. And you got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. This is the Space Show, Australia, on 88.3 Southern FM.
Joining me now is Peter Aylward from the Space Association of Australia. Peter, what can you tell me about Charlie Duke?
Charlie, a true gentleman. He was out in Australia speaking at various schools around Melbourne, and he spent about eight or so days here. And we managed to make contact with him and his organisers, and he very generously gave us some time together and came into the studio here and told us his story, and he's got a fascinating story. He was born in 1935, October 3rd, 1935, in Charlotte, North Carolina. And the interview will take us through his life and his career, going from his early days in North Carolina up to getting into the military and then eventually heading to the moon. And then we progress on to talk about his post-flight career and also his post-NASA career and some of the changes that that has undergone in his world. And he shares that with us in basically the third part of the interview.
Let's have a listen to the first part of our conversation with Charlie Duke. Charlie Duke, welcome to the Space Show on Southern FM.
Andrew, good to be with you. Thank you so much.
Perhaps you could run us through a few of your formative childhood experiences.
I'd be happy to. I grew up in a very small town in South Carolina. My ambition was from earliest childhood was to serve my country. Dad had been in Navy veteran, World War II, served in the South Pacific. And so my heroes were the World War II Army, Air Force, Navy men that fought. And so I wanted to go to the Naval Academy. So in the 10th grade, I decided that's what I wanted to do. I had to go off to boarding school so that I could pass the exams into the Naval Academy. So my parents sent me off to a boarding school my last 2 years of high school, years 11 and 12. And I found that a very rewarding experience, and it gave me a good military background for entrance into the Naval Academy. Gave me a wonderful education that I could not have gotten in my little town of South Carolina. So all of that working towards the goal was to get into the Naval Academy, to get to graduate and to become a naval officer. Turned out when I got to the Naval Academy, I fell in love with airplanes rather than ships, and ended up being selected for flight training for the U.S. Air Force when I graduated. So that's how I got into the Air Force.
Yes, it struck me as rather strange that you went to a naval academy, but actually went into the Air Force.
Well, that's back in those days, there was no Air Force Academy. The first Air Force Academy class was 1959, and I'm graduating in 1957. So when I started at the Naval Academy, there wasn't even an opportunity to go to the Air Force Academy. However, they would allow 25% of each class from Annapolis and West Point to volunteer for the Air Force. It was a very popular program, and so I volunteered to go into the Air Force and was selected.
And what was it about airplanes that attracted you?
It was just the thrill of the speed and the adventure of flying up among the clouds. It was just a fascinating experience, and I can remember this was early days of jet airplanes, and I can remember in South Carolina being out in the woods and looking up and seeing a contrail go over, and I kept dreaming about making a contrail, and the way to make a contrail was being in the Air Force in a military jet, and so that was one of the things that hit me, but just the desire to for the thrill of aviation and the adventure of it was what drove me there.
And so the Air Force was a great career for you?
It was. I never regretted one moment of choosing the Air Force for my career. They gave me great training in flight school. I got my wings. Advanced training was fantastic. I went to Germany for 3 years. Was in Germany from 1959 until 1962. So I was there when they built the Berlin Wall. I was there when Yuri Gagarin went up into space and when Alan Shepard went into space. And I can remember vividly President Kennedy announcing the Apollo program while I was a young lieutenant serving in the Air Force in Germany.
At that time, did you ever think that you might become
an
astronaut?
I didn't think we'd do it, you know, at 15 minutes in space. And he's committed us to go to the moon and return safely. And all of our pilots in our squadron hooted at him. Yeah, sure, you know, we're going to do that. And the most amazing thing about it, though, was 8 years and 2 months later, I'm in mission control talking to Neil Armstrong when he landed on the moon. So it was a fascinating program, it turned out. I didn't think we could do it, but we did. With all the dedication of hundreds of thousands of people working on that program, and it taught me a lesson in teamwork and delivering under pressure, especially after we had the accident that killed Gussom White and Chaffee in Apollo 1. You know, we were basically dead in the water, but everybody pitched in and made the changes that were required, and we flew it, and it worked, and we landed on.
Now, your time in the Air Force in Germany was a time of great tension between the two superpowers.
That's correct.
Any experiences with that, sort of facing up against the Russians?
Nothing major, I would say. We used to tease everyone. We would fly as fast as we could go towards the East German or the Czechoslovakian border and to see how fast it took them to scramble and intercept us. And when we get to the border, we'd all both turn and go sideways like this. And so we had some things like that. I intercepted a Russian airliner one time, and I remember flying real close to the border at real low altitude trying to intercept a light aircraft that had wandered over from the Czechoslovakian side. But you know, I had some minor emergencies that were memorable, but nothing where I had to eject and any crashes. So I was very fortunate.
What type of aircraft were you flying?
We had F-86, the D model, which was an interceptor version first, and then my squadron transitioned to the F-102. The Delta Dagger, and it was a tremendous airplane. It had missiles and a very good radar, and it was still the same mission, fighter interceptor. So we were sitting alert to intercept any the war started, we were the first to get launched.
And when you came back to America, you went into the flight test school?
No. When I got back, over in Germany, the Air Force back then was encouraging people like me to go to graduate school. And so I volunteered for graduate school, and I chose aeronautics and astronautics. And they selected me to go to MIT. So I moved back to the States and Boston area in the summer of 1962 and started my 2 years as a master's program at MIT. There, that same summer, I met my wife, Dorothy, and we fell in love, me faster than she, but she eventually said she'd marry me. And so I spent 2 years at MIT, and that's really where I really got excited about the space program. I met some astronauts who were coming to MIT. Turned out MIT had the contract to build the Apollo Guidance and Navigation System. And so my master's thesis was on the guidance and navigation system on Apollo. And we had to determine whether an astronaut could mark on a star with a spacecraft that's drifting around. And we proved we could. It was a statistical study, and we proved you could do it. And so NASA accepted our work and accepted this design, if you will, of a guidance and navigation system. And there I met Charlie Bassett, I met Don Isley, and several other of the third group of astronauts. And they were so enthusiastic and so excited and so pumped up, if you will, about this career as an astronaut. And they said, "You ought to try this, Charlie." It says, you know, I was being Air Force and pilot. And I said, "Well, what I got to do?" He said, "Well, you need to, you probably ought to get to test pilot school, and then you'd be prime candidate." So my second year at MIT, I volunteered for test pilot school. And I had the right education, the right background educationally and flight training-wise, and so I was selected. We moved to California, and for the next year, I was a student in the test pilot school with a very famous test pilot as my boss, Chuck Yeager, who was the first human being to fly faster than the speed of sound. He was an encourager, a great motivator, a great role model, and I graduated in the summer of 65, and that was in August.
You're listening to The Space Show on 88.3 Southern FM, and in case you've been wondering, that has you've been listening to the voice of Apollo 16 moonwalking astronaut Charlie Duke. Charlie spent 3 days on the moon walking around driving a car back in 1972, 44 years ago. Let's go back to Charlie.
In the next month, I read an article that in a paper that NASA's selecting another group of astronauts. And so it listed the qualifications, and I said, "That's me." So I volunteered. And
so that was the third group of astronauts, wasn't
it? No, we were the fifth, actually.
Oh, fifth, yeah. Yes.
The third group was the likes of Gene Cernan and Walt Cunningham and Don Isley and Charlie Bassett, Buzz Aldrin was in the third group. So those kind of guys. In between us and they were the a group of scientists. They had, I think, five scientists that they picked. And then our group came on board. We were all military. There were some civilians, but everybody had a military background in aviation. So we were either civilian pilots like Fred Hayes or Jack Swigert, but they had been trained in the military. But most of us were active duty military.
Mm-hmm. So you applied for the job, How did you find out you got it?
I got a phone call from the director of flight crew operations, Deke Slayton, who was one of the original seven mm-hmm. astronauts. And he gave me a call and said, Charlie, this is Deke. Would you like to come to work for us? And hoo-ha, you know, I was bouncing off the walls. I said, you bet I want to come to work for you. So he said, well, plan on being here on the, I don't know, 1st of April or whenever it was, but it was the next spring in 1966. And I told my boss, and Yeager was all for it. And so we went, we moved to Houston and started my career in April of 1966 as an astronaut.
Do you think Yeager would have liked to have become an astronaut?
I don't think so. He was, in the earlier days when he would have been qualified, it seemed like they were just going to be human guinea pigs, you know, testing kind of human beings, stand it in space.
Spamming the can.
Yeah, they didn't want to put any windows in the spacecraft. They didn't want to give any manual control. But the original seven, they fought hard for that. And but Yeager had, he was, I'd never heard him say he wouldn't do it, but he seemed like it was aviation was, and airplanes was his thing instead of spacecraft. And I think he was 12, let's see, he's just turned 90, so he's 12, 13 years older than I am. So that would have put him, and if in those early days, 1959, he might have been on the edge of the maximum age. I know by the time I got selected, he was too old because the limit was 36 years old back then.
Now, during your astronaut training, any highlights stand out?
Well, I enjoyed geology. None of us had any experience in geology except for Jack Schmidt, who ended up flying on Apollo 17. He had a PhD in geology, so he was basically one of our instructors. But we had a group of instructors from all over the United States who were tops in their field of in field geology, volcanic, sedimentary rock, igneous rocks. And I really enjoyed the geology training because it got you out of the office. You were out in the field for 3 days a month and, you know, walking and seeing this magnificent parts of the U.S. and Hawaii. And so it was geology training I really enjoyed.
Were you with Eugene Shoemaker at any time?
We were. He was one of our prime instructors, and he didn't go on every geology trip, but he was there a lot, and he was also one of our prime instructors in classroom work in geology. The primary guys were people from the United States Geological Service had a lunar laboratory up in Flagstaff, Arizona, and we worked with them a lot. And Lee Silver was another from Caltech, a very famous geologist. He's still alive. The other was Bill Mulberger, who was turned out to be the head of our science team. He was from the University of Texas and head of the Department of Geology. He passed away a couple of years ago. But they became lifelong friends. We were so close in training and, 6 years with them. And so it was really very special.
Now, even today, astronauts, after their basic training, get given assignments that before they get a roster to a flight. I believe one of your assignments was working with the Lunar Module Engine.
That's correct. It was started out as a propulsion. I was monitoring propulsion, and that included the Saturn V's. So I was watching the development and the testing of the F1 engines, the J2s, was attending design reviews and progress meetings at Marshall Space Flight Center, where I got to meet Vern Braun and his team. And then as it progressed, I started monitoring the mostly the lunar module engines for the astronaut office. And I remember we were having some trouble qualifying the ascent engine. There was a little instability. And so we, not we, but the head of the Apollo program, who was George Lowe at the time, formed this team of the propulsion experts from Mission Johnson Space Center, and I was on that team as an astronaut representative. And we went around to the present contractor and then visited other contractors and made a recommendation after a couple of months that we should change contractors. And it was a big decision on my part. You know, we were months from flying the lunar module on a schedule, and if we changed contractors here in the middle of the stream and it didn't work, we were dead in the water. So it wasn't a decision that we took lightly. But Lowe made the decision, okay, we'll go with Rocketdyne. And Rocketdyne took the basic engine but redesigned the injector plate. That was the problem. They started testing it almost within months, and it passed every test. So within 6 months, we had a qualified engine, and so we were able to basically stay on track with a lunar module that would flew on Apollo 9 and then went to the moon on Apollo 10.
By all accounts, the Mercury astronauts had to sort of thump the table a bit to get their way on certain things. Your group of astronauts have to do the same, or was it
sometimes? Sometimes you had to pound the table. We got to do this. This you need to change this. And if you could convince them that it was safety of flight or something that was critical to mission success, you would get it done, and they would make the decision. And that's why I liked Apollo so much. It was so dynamic. A lot of decisions. Direct, you've got to do this. And they'd say, yes, okay. And the next day you'd see the decision being implemented. Mm-hmm. Whereas later on I worked on Space Shuttle. That was the most frustrating 3 years I ever had, because we were all in meetings and we argued about coefficients of drag and coefficients of this and with brakes and drag chutes and design, and nothing was getting done. You just went to meetings constantly, and it took quite a while to get past that inertia and let's get going on a real design. And so after I left, then things picked up really quick. But I got frustrated, and that's why I left the program in early 76.
You're listening to The Space Show on Southern FM and with our exclusive interview with Apollo 16 moonwalking astronaut Charlie Duke.
Now let's move on towards the flights of Apollo 8, 9, 10, well, 7, of course, and 11. What were you doing during those times?
I was monitoring during Apollo 7, 8 and 9, I was monitoring the engines still going to Marshall. And then I got put on the support crew for Apollo 10. And my job was to be on the team that developed the lunar module activation and checkout procedures and the descent procedures for activation, checkout, and landing for the Apollo 10. Now there wasn't any landing, but we developed those procedures to take you down to landing, and the procedures to abort that and back into orbit. And so it was a very dynamic time, and it was if you remember, the flights were going off like every 2 months. Mm. And so we had to be real quick with the procedures and real quick with the implementation of the changes, if you will, it was that the crew would like in the simulator. And as a result, and then as a result of support crew and that being that involved, I also got put on the mission control team as CAPCOM. Generally, that didn't happen. You know, the support crew did that, and then was somebody else was in mission control, an astronaut always, but somebody else that wasn't so intimately involved. But they said, look, why don't you do this? You develop the procedures with your team. You know them all. You're really familiar with them, and we want you in mission control. So I went on Gene Kranz's team for that activation checkout part of the mission and was there in mission control for Apollo 10. And as we activated the lunar module and started to descent just like we had trained and developed. And then that was a prelude. And if that mission went well, then it meant the next mission we were going to attempt the landing. And we actually had three crews in training for landing, Apollo 11, 12, and 13, not knowing which one would actually get it done, but they were all in training. So as a result of Apollo 10 going so well, the mission control team just shifted over, and I did the same thing on Apollo 11. Developed all those. There was just a few changes, but there were some, and we did the changes to those procedures and the landing attitudes and all of that we worked out. And so I was in mission control for the landing on Apollo 11, which was a great honor for me, and I was really humbled that I had a chance to be involved in so intimately in that historic mission, especially from the mission control side.
What was the feeling in the days leading up to Apollo 11, that it would be successful or unsuccessful?
I think the feeling was it was going to be successful because the Apollo 10 mission had went so well in lunar orbit. The lunar module performed basically flawless. We had a couple of maneuvers that were surprised us, but it was a switch in the wrong position. And when we went from the primary guidance to the abort guidance, we had programmed in the abort guidance a new attitude, and the thing just spun around real fast and scared the crew and scared us. And what happened? And then everybody realized that we made a mistake. So we fixed all that. But it went so well, and so I felt like we were going to make it on Apollo 11 until we, you know, then when we were actually doing it, the activation and checkout went well, but when the descent started, it seemed like the wheels were coming off, you know, the communication problems, data dropout. We had to reorient a couple of times to get the antennas right. Then the computer was overloading, and it kept repeating. I thought we were – when I saw that 1201 alarm, I said, we're dead. It's an abort. But we weren't, because it wasn't an abort. And Steve Bales, the guidance controller, knew the system so well, said, we're go flight, and we continued going on these alarms as they kept going. And then, of course, you remember we had them targeted into the wrong area, and Neil couldn't land because of this very rough, undulating, and boulder-strewn territory. And so he had to fly over this and then slow up and land, start down, and that took a lot of extra fuel. So now we got a fuel problem, and I called Eagle 60 seconds. He had 60 seconds to land. I called Eagle 30 seconds, and he still wasn't on the ground. He's close, but not on the ground. And 13 seconds later, we had contact, engine stop, and so we made it. But we were 17 seconds away from calling an abort. Now, I believe that if in mission control, if we'd have called an abort, we still had about 4% fuel, and that was to give a positive rate of climb. But if Neil would have, he was so close, he would have used that fuel to land instead of aborting. As Alan Bean said, I mean, that wouldn't have been the right stuff to abort the mission 30 feet off the moon. So he would have landed, I'm convinced.
How low could you have gotten before in order to still be able to abort?
Well, you can abort 2 feet off the moon. Right. If, in fact, we had the lunar module would land on a 10-degree slope, and you could land, and if you landed slow enough at a low rate of descent, it would be stable on a 10-degree slope. Be very difficult to work around that, but it would. But if you landed real hard and it hit that slope, it would turn over. Mm-hmm. And in simulation, we did a lot of turnovers. And if you caught it fast enough, you could hit the abort stage and it would fire the engine and you'd get off. So you could be on the moon and abort. But the idea was if you were several thousand feet up and you developed this problem and mission control called an abort, then you'd throttle up to maximum power and you'd start a positive rate of climb. And so that was the idea, to leave 4% fuel or thereabouts. So if you had an abort low down, he could throttle up, get a positive rate of climb, and then abort stage. And then the ascent engine would take you back into orbit.
And you've been listening to Apollo 16 astronaut Charlie Duke. Charlie flew on the Apollo 16 mission back in 1972 with his commander, John Young, and with the command module pilot, Ken Mattingly. Ken Mattingly was originally scheduled to be on Apollo 13, but he was bumped off at the last minute, and they made a bit of a movie about that. In fact, Charlie was responsible for that because he inadvertently exposed him potentially to the measles. Turned out that he never got the measles and it was a bit of an overkill, but as a result, he was bumped off Apollo 13 and came back into the mix and actually got to fly Apollo 16, which I think he's probably the luckiest Apollo astronaut, because on Apollo 16 he actually got to do a deep spacewalk and spent a lot more time on lunar orbit. Apollo 16 landed in the Descartes region of the moon, and they conducted three EVAs. They took a car and did 27.6 kilometres of driving. They got 95.8 kilograms of lunar samples, and they spent a total of 71 hours on the moon before coming back up and rejoining Ken and then returning back to the Earth. So Charlie will be back with us again next week, and indeed the week after. We had a very extensive interview with him, so we've broken it up into three parts. Fascinating listening, and the man is truly worth your time listening to. This will also be podcast, so you'll be able to go to the website and listen to it in a couple of days as well. And with that, I'll hand back to Andrew.
I'm Apollo 16 astronaut Charlie Duke, the 10th man to walk on the moon. And you got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. This is the Space Show, Australia, on 88.3 Southern FM.
The Great Southern Sounds of Melbourne, 88.3 Southern FM.